Okay. Okay. Seeing as Elvis has left the building, safe to start. My name is Martin Grant. I am still the Dean of Science at McGill University, whatever that means. Welcome, everyone, especially with our two great challenges tonight. One, this awful room. So I apologize for that. We wanted to get a better room, but there's so much construction going on campus that there are limited places we have available for rooms, and it's the best we were able to get. The second reason, I can't remember, there's something else going on tonight. I can't quite remember what it was. There's some other problems going on, but I've been assured that we will be given live updates if there's potential good news or unfortunate bad news that will be called forward during the lecture. Welcome to the second to last lecture of the Spring 2010 Mini-Science Series. As you know, the series has tackled the alarming pervasiveness of pseudoscience. Last week we had Dr. Brian Alters talking about evolution. And as this is a faculty of science event, we have, of course, a skill testing question. Well, there's not many consequences to our skill testing questions, I've noticed, but in any case, despite scientific proof, so here's the question. Despite scientific proof, is it still necessary to debate the opponents to evolution theory, and how do you recommend doing this? Is it an essay question? No, address it on a case-to-case basis. Okay. Excellent. First prize is a firm handshake from the dean, and the second prize, two firm handshakes from the dean. At the end of tonight's lecture, we'll ask you to write down questions that I will ask Ariel at the end of the lecture. And again, legibility is a plus and worth an extra score. Tonight's mini-science topic is homeopathy, delusion or dilution. And our speaker is Dr. Ariel Fenster. Ariel's right here. Ariel is a native of the wine-growing area of Bergerac, France, and holds a master's degree from the University of Paris and a PhD from McGill. He is well-known as a science communicator, and he will talk about that a little bit in his lecture of the Office of Science and Society at McGill. He's given more than 600 invited lectures in English and in French on a variety of topics, from the ABC of vitamins to the chemistry of wine, the science of art, science friction. His French television show, La Chimie à Fête, in Montreal, attracted more than 370,000 visitors over 5 months. His contributions to teaching and to the popularization of science have been recognized by numerous awards, among them from the Royal Society of Canada, the McNeil Medal for the Public Awareness of Science, and the Award for Excellence in Chemical Teaching by the U.S. Chemical Manufacturers Association. Tonight, Ariel will critically examine the principles, the history, and the reasons for the enduring popularity of homeopathy as dilution or delusion. Ariel, it's all yours.
Thank you. Thank you. Alors, ça me fait vraiment très plaisir d'être avec vous. Oh, no, today is Wednesday. No, today is in English. I'm sorry. Anyway, it's a great pleasure for me to be able to participate to this event. And the topic that we're going to be covering is homeopathy. And it's really a fascinating topic. And as you will see, that really touched me in a very, very special way. But before we get started, as Grant mentioned, I just want to say a few things about the Office for Science and Society. I teach chemistry. I'm a chemist, and I don't have to tell you that we chemists, we have an image problem. this is the way we tend to be perceived by the general public. You know, we wear these white lab coats and we have a test tube coming out from our breast pocket. Actually, some people believe that we chemists are a completely different breed from anybody else. Now, this is the reason why a number of years ago, actually 20 years ago, was my two colleagues, Professor Schwartz, that you will not recognize on the right, and Professor Hopp on the left, we started the Office for Science and Society. This was when we were young and full of enthusiasm. Today, we are not as young, but still as enthusiastic, and we have all sort of, we founded the Office for Science and Society, and we have all sort of activities in Montreal, around Montreal, across Canada, and actually across North America. We give courses, we give public lecture, we do TV and radio presentation, and all in all, between the three of us, we, with our course and lecture, we cover approximately 10,000 people, and with the media, about 400,000 people. A lot of it is through the work of Dr. Joe. Now, one thing I'd like to mention also is that we offer at McGill the courses called The World of Chemistry. This is very special. As you can see, there are four different courses covering food, diversity, which is all the different aspects of technology, drugs, environment. And what's so special with these courses is that there is no prerequisite. They are open to all. You can take it in whatever order you want. And they are the most popular non-compulsory courses at the university. We get up to 1,000 students per semester. Now, what you're going to see tonight on homeopathy is part, or an expanded part, of the chemistry of drug course, which covers many aspects of the medical world, including something that, of course, is very dear to me, the chemistry of love. Now, another thing that is special is that these lectures are recorded, and it's available on the website, which is called COOL, the COOL website. And actually, you can go on this website, our courses, and actually all the courses, not all the courses, many of the courses at McGill are actually recorded as well. So our student can go and look at the lecture. This is what the website looks like, and you know, you can go back to the World of Chemistry courses, or if you ever also always wanted to know everything about organic chemistry, here is your chance. You get a chance, you can get the possibility of doing that as well. All in all, at McGill, 40 lecture theaters and 300 courses altogether are equipped for this lecture recording system. And 50,000 students a year have access. Of course, they have the student courses. The same student can take more than one course where it is recorded. So which means that our student does not have to come to class. He can attend our lectures at home. Actually, he doesn't even have to be at home. It can, for that matter, it can be anywhere in the world. Well, if they don't have to come to class, what about attendance? Well, attendance can suffer. But actually, in all honesty, all in all, they do come to class and they still enjoy our lectures. Now, also, we use clickers. You all were given a clickers. And this, I find, really made a big difference in our teaching. It's interactive. We can ask questions. And just to make sure that your clicker works, we'll start with the first question. Ready? Okay. I'll read it for you. Who was the lead actor in the 1967 movie The Graduate? Don't say it, just click. Now, the reason I ask this question for the following reason. You know, it is very often you tell your students, you remember that movie, and they look at you. You realize you're a completely different generation. So I ask this question, who was the lead actor in the 1967 movie The Graduate? So we'll see how you answer to this one. Okay. Just a sec, we'll, as you'll see, it will come up. Wow. This shows that we are more or less the same age group. Well, of course, it is Dustin Hoffman. So you see how it works, and throughout the lecture I'll be asking questions so you can participate. Okay, so let's now really get started with tonight's topic, the illusion of dilution. And as I told you, this topic, homeopathy, actually touched me personally. This is me with my two children and my wife, summer 1986, 24 years ago. I was in perfect health, and over the course of a few months, I started having a medical problem. To anybody else, maybe nothing out of ordinary because they wouldn't notice it, but I started having burning sensation first in my finger, then in my arm, and eventually all over my body. The type of sensation I had, I don't know if it happened to you, is that when you go outside and your fingers get very cold and then you come outside inside, then they warm up and it really burns. Well, imagine you have this 24 hours a day. So this was, I felt terrible, as you can imagine. I couldn't sleep. Eventually, I couldn't even drive the car. I was in so much pain. I went to see all sorts of specialists. I tried anti-inflammatory drug. I went to see rheumatologists, allergists, neurologists, pain clinic, name it. Nobody could actually help me. Actually, nobody could even tell me what I had, which is the most frustrating thing for a scientist. You want to find out. Well, I remember at least one doctor was very good. He said, you know, the good news is as long as we don't know what it is, there is hope. So eventually, I went for alternative treatment. I tried meditation, relaxation therapy, acupuncture, naturopath, cod liver oil, evening primrose oil. I tried various diets. One of the diets was very painful. It was no wine. But eventually, in desperation, somebody mentioned to me that they knew an homeopath. Actually, this was interesting because this homeopath actually was a medical doctor who was interested in homeopathy. So I went to visit him. I mean, you know, when you're in pain, you're willing to try anything. So I went to visit him. And what I liked with him is that the first thing he told me about homeopathy is, I don't know how it works, but I seem to get good results. Because actually I had seen other people that pretended that they were homeopaths, but it was total nonsense. It was a sort of nonsensical jargon that they would use, pretending that it was science. Anyway, he spent a great deal of time with me. And the first thing he did, actually, before he talked to me, he gave me a questionnaire. He gave me a questionnaire where I was supposed to report symptoms. Okay? I had to keep it for a week and write down various conditions. Describe all mental or nervous feelings and conditions, such as a like and dislike, desire, fears, timidity, hurried feeling, and so on. Whether easily startled or starting from sleep, or when falling asleep, or from noise, or from being touched. You can see that is very, very detailed. Actually, he also asked me about my bowel condition, the color. Can you imagine looking at this every morning? The color, the odor, if it's hard, dry, large, pasty, bloody, frothy. We're talking about detailed description. And eventually, after he looked at it, we had a long talk, he discussed it, and he gave me a number of pills. I mean, take these pills twice a day. So I started taking the pill. And over the course of approximately a month, I started getting better. And eventually, slowly, and it took actually another 3 to 6 months, actually my symptoms went away. Now, what was it? Well, was it the placebo effect? We'll be talking about this. Or, you know, I was trying everything at that time. There were so many different factors. For instance, you remember that diet, or is it possible that what I had was self-limiting? In fact, most diseases go away on their own. So it could have been that, or it could have been that I went into remission. I also was doing a lot of exercise at that time, trying to in pain. I was doing a lot of swimming, actually. So it could have been that as well. Well, eventually, and that took some time, doctors told me that what I had had, because at that time they did not know that disease, okay? But what I'd had was something known as fibromyalgia, which 24 years ago was not recognized as a condition. Whatever, this actually got me interested in homeopathy, and I went into try to find out more about it. Well, what is homeopathy? Try to answer, well, let's see how much you know about the principle. Which is correct about homeopathy? Was it developed by, spelling mistake, was it developed by Socrates in 400 BC? Was introduced by a medical doctor? Was it first used in France by Marie Antoinette? Okay. It required extensive medical training, or none of the above is correct. So let's see how you answer to this one. Actually, most of you are correct. The concept was introduced by a medical doctor, by the name of Samuel Hahnemann. Can you see? Have you trouble seeing? It's okay? But no, they need the light for the filming. But can you see enough? That's all, yeah. Okay. So this was an interesting individual. At that time, medicine was very brutal. And he was really turned off by the methods that were used, and he said that he wanted to develop something that was more humane. And his theory of homeopathy came quite by accident. One day, he took a large amount of Peruvian bark. Peruvian bark is a substance that actually gives quinine. And when taking large amount of that Peruvian bark, he developed a very high fever. Well, quinine is for the treatment of malaria. Okay? One of the symptoms of malaria is high fever. So in his mind, he said, oh, when I take large amount of Peruvian bark, I get a fever, but in small amount, actually, it treats these particular symptoms, very important. Homeopathy always looks at symptoms. And he went on trying with various substances. Finally, belladonna, which is a flower, a plant, also known as a deadly nightshade. He noticed that when he took large amount, his skin got all flushed up and he had dilated pupils. Well, he said, well, if that's the case, in small amount, it should be used for the treatment of high fever with staring eyes. That's the way actually it is described. Not that I would suggest that you try that, but he took large amount of arsenic. And he noticed that he had some stomach problem. Oh, large amount of arsenic gives stomach problems. Therefore, in small amount, it should treat this symptom. Homeopathy comes from the Greek homeos pathos, meaning a similar suffering, similar symptoms, if you want. So what homeopaths do is that they carry out what is known as provings, from the German Prüfung. And essentially, the basic idea is that you try different substances at different dilution, and then you keep a diary of all the symptoms. Remember, again, the word symptoms. All the symptoms, or sensation in this case, that you will experience under the influence of these remedies. Symptoms such as dreams. You're supposed to write down the dreams you experience when you're taking a particular remedy, a particular substance, and that at different dilution. And then, usually, following the work of Hahnemann, he had a number of provers, anything that would be between, let's say, two and a dozen. Okay? And all these provers would gather their data and give them to the master prover. And the master prover will record there in a book called the Materia Medica. And this is sort of the Bible of homeopathy. That's where all this, that's from this book, or from this proving that are inscribed in this book, that all the homeopathic remedy are developed. Now, the principle of homeopathy is, of course, a similarity. Similar biscurantur, curing through similarity. Curing through similarity of symptoms. Interestingly enough, Hahnemann was not interested at all in, I think I wrote it down, was not interested at all in what was happening in the body, in any physiological change in the body. That did not interest him at all. He didn't want to know how it worked. The only consideration he had were the symptoms similar. He was looking only at the symptom. And essentially, homeopathy is a theory of similarity, and it is in contrast to conventional medicine, which is known as allopathy, against, although doctors do not like that term, but that's a term that they use by homeopaths. Allopathy, which is the theory of contrary. And essentially, if you have a high fever, what you want to do is that you want to suppress it. Contraria, contratris, curantur. Cure through the theory of contrast. Well, of course, this is very much against the evidence-based medicine. Evidence-based medicine is you want to prove effectiveness beyond natural healing, the natural healing process, and beyond the placebo effect. And as I said, Samuel Hahnemann was not interested at what was happening in the body. In normal medicine, you want to know how a drug actually works. You want to know what it does into the body. Hahnemann, in fact, said, no, I'm only interested in the symptoms, not the cause, not the physiological process responsible for the disease. Now, this is interesting because this is actually in the contrast to complementary and alternative medicine. Because in complementary alternative medicine, they say that they treat actually what's happening. They want to find out what's happening, what the cause of the disease. Okay? We agree? What the cause is. And the people that believe in complementary alternative medicine will say that regular doctors, they don't care what happens in the body. They just want to cure. Okay? So this is really quite interesting that complementary and alternative medicine is in contrast to homeopathy. Complementary and alternative medicine, they want to find out what's happening in the body. By the way, I have a problem with that term, complementary and alternative medicine. Okay? Because either medicine works or it doesn't work. Okay? If it works, then it's not alternative anymore. Okay? So this whole concept of alternative medicine is really problematic to me. Then, on his own, without any scientific basis, he decided, and that's a word that one has to use, that the more diluted the solution, the more effective the remedy becomes. So the first theory of homeopathy is a theory of similarity, and the second one is a theory of dilution, the theory of infinitesimal. The more diluted it is, the more effective it actually becomes. Strange. Let's take an example. Let's take snake poison. Okay? If you are poisoned with the toxin of the bushmaster snake, you're going to get circulatory problem. Okay? It actually is going to affect the coagulation of your blood. According to homeopathy, then, diluted form of snake venom should be used to treat circulatory problem, okay? Because similar type of symptoms, but diluted. But how diluted? How is this actually carried out? How do you prepare an homeopathic remedy? Well, when you go to the pharmacy and you see an homeopathic preparation, you'll see that term, 30, well, it's not an X, it's 10 10, the Roman numeral 10, 30, 10. What it means is that this preparation has been prepared in the following fashion. The concentrated substance, snake venom in this case, you take, let's say, one drop of it, and you add it to 9 drops of solution. The solution could be either water or alcohol. Then you take one drop of that diluted solution, and then you add it to it. You add it to 9 drops again. So you have got another dilution by a factor of 10. And then you keep doing it like this until you repeat it 30 times. Okay? Now, by that time, you have a dilution factor of 10 to the 30. Okay? Now, 10 to the 30, wow, what does it represent, 10 to the 30? Well, a dilution of 10 to the 30 is equivalent to one drop of water in what? The size of an Olympic swimming pool, the volume of Lake Ontario, the volume of the Pacific Ocean, the volume of all the oceans in the world, or none of the above. Well, I'm sorry, most of you are wrong. Correct answer is none of the above. A 10 to the 30 dilution is equivalent to one drop in 50 times the volume of the Earth. Okay? Now, this is a common homeopathic remedy. This is what it works out to. Okay? No, I shouldn't say that before I go into it. Now, 10 to the 30, that's for easy problems. For serious medical problem, you need more dilution. Okay? So you go 30 to the C, and C is for 100. So instead of doing the dilution each time by a factor of 10, you do it by a factor of 100. So you take one drop plus 99 drop. One drop of that solution plus 99 drop. One drop of that solution plus 99 drop. Now, I'm not going to ask you what volume it corresponds to. I'm just going to tell you directly. This is for serious medical problems at that type of dilution. But that's not all. That's not all. Because between every dilution, you have to energize the molecule. You have to potentiate them. Okay? And how do you do that? Well, actually, Hahnemann had developed a method. You took a leather material. You can take a leather belt. Actually, use the Bible. Okay? It has to be leather, though. And you hit the solution in between each dilution. You hit at it at least 10 times. Okay? This energizes the remedy, okay? By hitting it on a leather belt or leather book. But one thing which is also, a characteristic of homeopathy, and that's why for a number of people it works, is that, as we have seen, the homeopathic practitioner takes a great deal of interest in his patient. You remember, I got this all this questionnaire. The doctor, quote-unquote, spent a great deal of time with me. So essentially what the homeopathic doctor will determine, again, the homeopathic doctor is not going to look at what's inside your body. He's not interested. He's interested in your personality, your symptom and your personality. So, for instance, this would be a Lachesi person. This would be a person for which Lachesi should really work. Okay? Physical appearance, freckled red head, overweight with bloated appearance, flick the tongue over the top lip. That poor lady is egocentric and jealous. She resists commitment. And among other things, well, that's good. She's concerned with world affairs. She's afraid of water. She's afraid of poisoning and of suffocation and death. And it goes on, okay? She feels better when she has bodily discharge. I'm not joking. This is part of the whole process. She likes pickles, olives, and oysters. She likes coffee, except during menopause. Okay? And the weak area of the body is the left side, and she has problem with blood and circulation. And eventually, the homeopathic practitioner will actually determine what she suffers from, and it would be something like this. Menopause with suspiciousness and a tendency to talk too much. This is an ideal candidate for lachesi. Okay? So then the practitioner will determine that she needs lachesi 30C, okay, every 12 hours for 7 days. Now, so this is actually complicated because there are different forms of homeopathy. There is classical homeopathy and there is quote-unquote modern homeopathy. In classical homeopathy, the practitioner will give you one remedy at a time, like lachesi. On the other hand, the classical homeopathy has been replaced with a form where you give more than one remedy at a time, mixed together. For instance, if you look at this one, Iasmus, it contains flowers extract, and look what? Tarantula extract. Okay? Should you worry? Well, it's D to the 15. That D stands again. Here it stands for 10. So it's 10 to the power 15, the dilution. So the amount is really negligible. And it's given to people that suffer from extreme restlessness with tendency to roll from side to side to relieve some symptoms, and people that feel better with music. And they will get better too with tarantula extract. Now, the good thing you can say about homeopathy is, in fact, that under normal condition, and we'll look at this in more detail, it is safe. I mean, that's very important. It is safe. Now, you have to understand that when Hahnemann introduced his concept, medicine, as we have just seen, was pretty brutal. Where bloodletting, purges, and the like. This was a treatment for earaches. You can imagine that certainly homeopathy was a much better approach. Another very important factor that one should not neglect when talking about homeopathy is that Hahnemann believed, and that was very, very special at the time, he believed in proper hygiene, he believed in fresh air, and believed in a good diet. So people that went to homeopathic hospital actually tended to be much better than the people that did not. And actually, the triumph of homeopathy in the 1850s was when there was epidemics of cholera, especially in London. There was a major one in London in 1854. People that ended up in a homeopathic hospital had a much better chance to get better than the people that went to a regular hospital. Now, if you look at what homeopathic hospital looked like, I wish a Jewish general would look like this today. It was extremely clean. And in fact, that cholera epidemics is interesting because it was the first example of the use of epidemiology to solve a problem. I don't know if you know the story of Dr. Snow. He noticed that people that were suffering from cholera were all around a special, in a very specific area, and they realized that they were all drawing water from a particular pump. And what he did, he removed the handle from that pump. And as a result, people stopped dying from cholera. And what is interesting, if you go to London, there is a reproduction of that pump. And just across the street, there is a John Snow pub, okay, in honor of him. So from the 1850 to the early 1900s, homeopathy became extremely popular because actually it worked better than regular medicine because there was no such thing as medicine as we know it today. And some of you may not know this, but Queen Elizabeth actually was the Montreal Homeopathic Hospital. And all in all in the States, there were 14,000 in the 1900. There were 14,000 homeopathic doctors and 20 medical schools. Starting in the early 1900, evidence-based medicine took over. Okay, we heard about vaccination and the like. So, other approaches worked, and actually slowly it supplanted homeopathy. This was until the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, and now, I don't have to tell you, homeopathy has become popular again. And it's part of the whole movement of holistic medicine. And as you understand why, as you have seen, homeopathic practitioner usually would spend a great deal of time with their patient, and it's something that is important. Of course, there is also some disenchantment with conventional medicine and also problem with the pharmaceutical industry, and actually that distrust is warranted in many, many cases. All in all, in Canada, 70% of the people use some form of alternative treatment, including herbal treatment and the like. And 70% is a large number. But I'm including all the herbal treatment, like echinacea and the like. So what about you? Okay. Do you make use of complementary and alternative treatment? Okay, this includes also herbal treatment. Vitamins also. Any form. Well, I wouldn't say vitamins, because vitamins is really not alternative. I would say like such things like echinacea, ginkgo biloba, this. Okay. Interesting point. Now, this question for people that use actually alternative treatment. As I said, the most common is herbal treatment. We'll see if that's the case as well. Meditation, chiropractic treatment, homeopathy. Acupuncture would be in the others. Yeah. So, as you see, this is actually the same for the population at large. It's herbal treatment as in general. How many actually use vitamin C against the common cold, just out of interest? Does it work? That's what I find. You know, I ask my student, and a great number of them use it, and I say, does it work? Most of them say no. And then I say, why do you use it? I mean, they realize that it doesn't work. In fact, there is no benefits in taking vitamin C against a common cold. Okay? It doesn't work. Okay? But if it makes you feel better, that's okay. And in terms of herbal treatment, which one of the following do you use most? I'm not surprised. Actually, that's what it's found for Canada at large, omega-3. That's the number one herbal, although it's not really herbal, but anyway, alternative treatment. Whatever it is, there is a great deal of money to be made in homeopathic remedies. It's a $500 million market in North America, about a tenth of that in Canada. So great deal of money. But the question is it dilution or delusion? Okay. Now, as you can see from this slide, there are all sorts of various treatments that you can have. I don't know if you're ready for this one. Actually, people spend money for that. So, the question there is that does homeopathy offer additional benefit beyond the placebo effect? Now, how do you find out? You carry out studies, of course. Okay. Now, I just want to spend a couple of minutes talking about the different type of studies, because we're constantly bombarded by studies. You'll open the paper and it will show, as study shows. Okay? What type of study under what condition? Well, the two main groups of studies are the observational study or the interventional study. As the terms imply, observational study, you don't, the scientist doesn't do anything. He looks at what's happening to different group of people, like cohorts. He looks at people, for instance, that eat lots of fruit and vegetable and people that do not. Okay? On the other hand, in an interventional study, also known as clinical studies or clinical trial, the scientist will give the substance to the people and will give it to different groups. Now, very important, when it comes to observational studies, where the assignment of subject is not controlled by the investigator, it can be either retrospective or prospective. And this is important because they are very different from one another, retrospective or prospective. Retrospective, as the term implies, is that you ask people, you have your groups of people, and you ask them questions as to what they ate over the last 20 years. Okay? Or often they use a cell phone over the last 5 years. You go back, you ask them questions. On the other hand, in the case of prospective studies, you start at time zero, okay, and then you follow them over long ahead, you follow them over a certain period of time. So what do you think? A new study published, and we'll use this as an example, a new study published just last month indicates that a diet rich in fruits and vegetables, you remember what study was? Has very little effect on lowering the risk of developing cancer. Wow, that was quite a shock. Okay, we had been told for years, including by the American Canadian Cancer Society, that eating lots of fruit and vegetable actually can lower the risk of developing cancer. Numbers that were bantered around like was 70%, 80%. And then this major study comes along and tells you that, hey, it actually doesn't work. And this was a very serious study. It involved 500,000 people in Europe, okay, 500,000 people. And, of course, we were at the office. We were inundated by phone calls. People say, well, all this year we have been told to eat lots of fruits and vegetables. Now you say it doesn't make any difference. Well, again, the key thing, actually, I wrote a whole op-ed page in La Presse on that. The key thing is that all these previous studies that show that there were some benefit were retrospective studies. You were asking people to remember how much fruit and vegetable they have eaten. And retrospective studies are not very good studies. The reason why they are used is that they are easily done. It doesn't require much. You just send questionnaire and you ask people to respond. But they are very easily biased. Okay? So that is the problem. On the other hand, the one that showed that there was very little benefit was a prospective study. Okay, so the people were followed, and they had to write down day by day as to how, and they didn't have to remember. They had to write day by day what they ate, how much vegetable they actually ate. So as I say, I wrote an article, an op-ed in La Presse on that. And the point I made is that this is the way science works. As science progresses, you get better and better tools. In the past, what was used were retrospective studies. Now they were able to use prospective studies that are more expensive, by the way, more costly, but they give better result. And this is a study that showed that there was no benefit in terms of cancer, in terms of eating fruits and vegetable. Does it mean that you should stop eating fruit and vegetable? No, of course not. Of course not. There are a number of factors to look at. This study was only looking at the benefits in terms of cancer. but there's still a great deal of benefits in terms of heart disease. Okay? And that is very, very important. Now, what is the number one cause of death in North America? It's heart disease. Okay? So this is certainly important. By the way, one little point I'd like to make. Okay? Is the incidence of cancer going up in North America? Overall? It is. Why is it going up? Because we're living longer. People don't realize this. And this is when you look at all, when you tell people, say, oh, yeah, all the people will tell you that all these chemicals in the environment. Look, all these people are dying from cancer. In the 1900, the life expectancy was at around, in Canada, was around 48 years. Okay. Today it's 82 years. Okay. The longer you live, the more are your chances of dying of cancer. Actually, there is an interesting point to be made. The more fruits and vegetables you eat, the more, the greater the chance of dying from cancer. Do you agree? Because, of course, since the leading cause of death in North America is heart disease, and we know that eating lots of fruits and vegetables are good in the prevention of heart disease, well, unfortunately, the greater the chance of developing cancer. So, the other type of study are the interventional study, and these are the ones that are more important, where the researcher actually takes charge, and where the material to be tested and the assignment of subject is controlled by the investigator, the assignment of subject. That is very important. When you choose your two groups, the control group and the active group, you want to determine, you want to be able that it's properly done. And this is what we call clinical trials. So, in this term, the first report of a clinical trial goes back to, when did they first start using clinical trial? Were they the French, the Greeks, the Hebrews, Egyptian, or the Sumerian? Essentially, you don't know. Actually, you'll be surprised. Hebrews. And for those of you who know the Bible, at least 6% may know it, there is this description in the book of Daniel. Okay? At this point, the Israelites had been taken prisoners or were prisoners of the Babylonians. And Daniel was one of them. And what happened is that the Babylonian king had taken the Jewish warriors and he wanted to train them for his personal guard. So he wanted to give them a good diet to be strong. Okay? So lots of meat, lots of wine, that was a good diet. Okay? Well, Daniel said, no. Please test your servant for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetable to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men with the royal food. That means the one with lots of meat and lots of wine. And treat your servant in accordance with what you see. So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they look healthier and better nourished than any of the young men with the royal food. So the guard took away the choice food, wine and meat, they were to drink, and gave them vegetable instead. See, already in the Bible, they realized through clinical trial that vegetables were better for health. Okay, now, the best clinical trial is the one that is double-blinded, which is randomized, and it is placebo-controlled. Now, as you all familiar, the placebo effect is a very important effect, is that if somebody believes that something is going to help them, it will. Placebo comes from the Latin to please. So we want to make sure, the clinical trial wants to make sure that what the patient feels is not just a placebo. So this is, all these studies are to determine the extent of the placebo effect. And this is where the term blinded study comes. In a blinded study, you have got two groups. One is given the active substance to be tested. The other one is given a placebo or sugar pill. And the reason why it's called a sugar pill is that both contain lots of sugar to disguise the taste, if there is one has a special taste. So you do it in this fashion. So this would be a blinded study. Okay, and the problem is, it's not always easy to blind a study. In other words, to have the two people not realizing what they take. Okay? For instance, how would you manage to blind an acupuncture study? That is not simple. Okay? How do you blind that? Well, actually, they do manage. What they do is that they use sham needles that are not really acupuncture needle. Also, they actually apply the needles to the points that are not the acupuncture points. And by the way, what did they find? Doesn't work very well, okay? When it's really properly double-blinded and randomized, it doesn't work too well. Now, a very important factor, okay, this I mentioned already, I answered it, so we can move on. So this is a blinded study. You have your two groups. One is given the control. The other one is given the one is given the active substance. The other one is given the placebo. What is a double-blind study? Well, in a double-blind study, it's very important that the clinician, the one that carries out the study, does not know which one is which. Very, very important. Because if I believe that this is, you know, one of these wonderful drugs I've just developed, what's going to happen is that you are the you get taking the active substance, you're taking the placebo, okay? I'll go to you and say, take this. And to you say, take this, okay? And actually, the subject will pick this up. And also in terms of evaluating the result. So and properly, it has to be double-blinded. So neither the subject nor the clinician know which one is which. Of course, somebody has to know, okay? And also, randomization is very important. Many of the studies that are carried out are properly double-blinded but are poorly randomized. Now, this is very important because when you assign your subject to the two groups, you have to make sure that they are totally, totally random. Like, for instance, let's say you're going to call for people and you say, okay, the first 20 people, I'm going to put them in the control group. The next 20 people, I'm going to put in the placebo group. Well, maybe the first 20 people are really the eager one or the one in good health, the one that could move. So it's very important that it should be properly done. And the standard for properly randomized, okay, I'm here, best properly randomized studies is to use a special form where people are asked to call to join the study. Okay? So in fact, the people that carry out the study don't know who actually called, and that it's done through a randomization program. So there's no human impact at all. That's the proper randomization. This is the way it is, has to be actually done. Just I want to mention, finally, there is what's called a meta-analysis. In a meta-analysis, what is done is that you combine the result of several studies together. And this is used when you have got a small group of people, you want to extend it, okay? So you want to have a larger pool to get better results. So there is still this problem of dilution, though, okay? How are we going to try to explain that something should work even though it has diluted to such an extent? Well, homeopaths have a very nifty way to get around this. They talk about water memory. Okay, in fact, they agree there at this dilution there is no molecules of the original substance left, but the water has acquired the memory of the substance. And I just want to bring in the story of Jacques Benveniste. Jacques Benveniste carried out a study where he found a biological effect at extreme dilution. He took an antigen, reacted with an allergen, and reacted with human basophil. He reacted them, and he found that there was a reaction even when the antigen was diluted to such an extent that there was nothing left. Okay? Why would it work? Because the water had acquired the memory. Water remembers. Now, notice, it was published in Nature. It's really quite amazing. Notice the dilution, 10 to the 120. So we're talking really extreme dilution. Now, we don't have that much time. I don't want to go through the whole story. Actually, Dr. Maddox, who came to McGill to give a talk, we asked him, how could you allow to have this published in Nature, even though it didn't make any sense? You say you wrote, readers of this article may share the incredulity of the many referees who have commented on several versions during the past months. The essence of the result is that an aqueous solution of an antibody retained its ability to evoke a biological response even when diluted to such an extent that there is a negligible chance, essentially zero chance, of there being a single molecule in any sample. Okay? So he agreed to have it published, but he said, we're going to go and check it afterward, which is, of course, a very, very odd thing. Now, what Dr. Maddox told us is that Benveniste was bothering him so much that he said, okay, I'll do it, but we'll check it afterward, which is, and he regretted this to his death. Anyways, so Dr. Maddox allowed this, and he went to visit Benveniste's lab in Paris, and he brought with him James Randi. I don't know if you're familiar with James Randi. James Randi is a debunker of claims of the paranormal. He got there, and he essentially, what was done, I have to explain the principle of the experiment. This is what we call a basophil, or a representation of a basophil cell. This is a representation of an antigen. And what happened is that when the antigen interact with the antibodies, the IgE, what happened? Granules are released, what I'm showing here. And when granules are released, there is a color change. Okay? So essentially, what the observer was trying to figure out is to see if there was a color change at very dilute solution, even though there was no antigen left. Why? Because the water had acquired the memory of the original substance. Now, when James Randi came to check it out, he noted already there was a problem. It seems that the experiment only worked well with a particular scientist. Also, it just happened that she was engaged to one of the director of the Boivin Laboratory, which is a big homeopathic lab in France. Actually, it's the number one in the world. Another thing that he noticed is that the results were just too neat, too good. Okay, you got that type of curve. Okay, right on. The results were right on. Well, what had happened is that the study had not been properly double-blinded. So what James Randi did is actually he made sure that the samples were completely blinded and that she did not know which one was which. And under this condition, what happened? No result. Okay, high dilution became a dilution. And actually, people made fun of the whole thing. Une grenouille est passée dans cette eau en 1789. Now, this refers to one comment Jacques Benveniste would make. He say, well, to explain what I'm doing, imagine that I take my car keys and I throw it in the Seine in Paris. I can drive down, or I can't drive, he has to take the train. I can go 100 kilometers down the Seine River, pick a few drops of water, and use that to start my car. Why? Because the water has acquired the memory of the car keys. So that's what they're referring to. There were even more, how could I say, I don't know which word to use, cynical comments that were made at that time. Excuse the language. So, in any case, it didn't make sense at all, but Jacques Benveniste would not give up, and he would insist that he was right, and eventually he was fired. He was fired from the institute where he was working in Paris. But he kept going, And actually, he founded his own institute and developed something quite interesting, homeopathic email. He claims that actually you could transfer the property of an homeopathic solution through the internet. Okay? So can you imagine in the morning you come in and you click? Okay. Well, essentially, it didn't come to anything, and eventually it died a few years ago, but till the last minute he believed that he was right. So, strictly speaking, the only explanation for the homeopathic benefit is the placebo effect. Now, the point, though, to be made, how can one explain that some studies show some benefits in homeopathy? You always will be brought to, yes, but there is a study that shows that it actually works. Well, what you have to look is at the quality of the study. I'm not going to go into it too much, but there is a measure which is called a JADAT score, which determines how good a study is. What do I mean by how good it is? I mean in terms of blinding, in terms of randomization. The higher the JADAT score, the better the quality of the study. And what you have is that going from left to right, you have JADAT score going up. Going from up to up, you get the ratio of benefits for placebo, homeopathy over placebo goes up. But what do you notice? You notice on the left-hand side, okay, where the JADAT score is very low, in other poor quality studies, you'll find that homeopathy actually works. Well, if the clinician has not properly blinded, he knows which one is which. Okay, but you notice that when you have high JADAT score, you know that essentially there is no benefit. You get something of one. Okay, the same thing as placebo. So essentially, this is the bottom line, because in 2005, The Lancet carried out a meta-analysis, okay, an analysis of analysis, if you want, of homeopathic treatment as compared to conventional medicine. And they studied 110 homeopathic trials, 110 matched conventional medicine. And eventually, they picked only the one that were of best quality, in both cases, homeopathic and conventional. Okay, and what they found that there were no benefits with homeopathic remedies beyond the placebo effect. And actually, at that time, The Lancet wrote an editorial, and the title of the editorial was The End of Homeopathy. But I don't think it is the end, but still it's interesting. Now, just to finish off, I just want to, if you think that homeopathy is strange, then this is even stranger. It's a derivation of homeopathy as applied to agriculture. It's known as biodynamic agriculture, developed by Rudolf Steiner. Okay? I don't know if any one of you know who Rudolf Steiner was. He founded, I can't even read it there, he founded a branch of philosophy known as theosophy, ontology, anthroposophy, analytical philosophy, stenography, or none of the above. Should it be interesting how many know of Rudolf Steiner? Well, not too many. Anthroposophy. Actually, there are schools, Rudolf Steiner school, some of you might be familiar. But essentially, biodynamics is a form of homeopathic farming, working, that's how it's described by the people that practice it, working via the subtle energies that allow and regulate living system using water that has been allowed a vortexial flow as the delivery mechanism. Well, what is it all about? It's strange, very, very strange. What you do in biodynamic, you have Steiner recommended, I think it's 9 different, he called them preparation. And this preparation was like, for instance, the cows or horn of cows that you will fill up with, you would fill up with horse manure, and you put it in the ground in the fall, and you dig it up in the spring. And this is the mixture that we use, that we'd use and dilute. You'd also use a bladder of animal with chamomile flowers. That was another preparation. You'd use a skull of animals filled up with, for instance, also cow manure. That was another one. And, of course, you had to apply a vortex. The vortex was very, very important. And dilute it. That's where it resembles homeopathy. You had to dilute it, and then you'd apply it to the field. Okay? So this is the principle. And another very interesting feature is that it, when you carried out a different procedure, it had to be done according to the movement of the planets, okay? The moon, the planets, and so on. For instance, in the terms of, there is biodynamic wine, by the way, and you had to pick up your grapes when Venus was in the Scorpion constellation, only at that time. Okay? Now, I just had the good fortune of last year going to Vinexpo, which is the greatest wine exhibition in the world, and I had the opportunity to try a whole bunch of biodynamic wine. And the only thing I can say, they are not bad. Now, just to finish off, I told you there's a great deal of money to be made in homeopathic remedy. And I just want to give you an example of one of these. This is oscillococcinum. Now, oscillococcinum gathered quite a bit of publicity during the H1N1 scare because it was recommended by homeopathic practitioner as a substitute to vaccination. And by the way, that's where homeopathy is dangerous, when it's taken as a substitute for something that will actually work. Now, what is oscillococcinum? Well, first, it's not cheap, okay? For 12 doses, you pay $22.99, and the composition is Annas barbare hepatis and Cordia extractum at 200 C. Annas barbare is a duck, okay? Hepatis is a heart, and hepatis is the liver, and cordis is the heart. So these are extract of duck's heart and liver diluted by a factor of 1 to 200. 1 to 200. That many zeros. Okay? Now, what you may find interesting, at this type of dilution, a single duck will bring you how much money? Well, what can I say? It's more expensive than foie gras. So essentially, I want to thank you. I hope you did enjoy this. But before I allow for question, I thought we'll arrange for a door prize. Okay? We picked somebody, and we made sure that our picking was properly randomized. Okay? So I ask Ingrid to go through all the phenomenon, okay? I understand that people have called in to register, okay? So this is a whole process. So somebody was picked through this very, very exact randomization program. Ingrid, okay? So that was totally randomized, completely randomized.
The randomized name is Ngar Metcalf.
Is the person here? Can you come down? Come on down! So, yeah? Come on. Okay, we never met before.
Never.
Okay, so you see, I had nothing to do with this, okay? So we had to make sure that the door price was appropriate. Actually, we did a perfect randomization, okay? And the door prize is a bottle of biodynamic wine. You're welcome. Okay, and you let me know how it tasted. Thank you.
Ask people if they could carefully write nice, short, legible questions, realizing the dean uses bifocals and is tired after a long day. I do have a question for the audience, however. How many in the room think the Habs are two down right now? How many think it's tied? How many think the Habs are two up? You guys are right.
How many minutes left? Which period is that? Which period? 2 minutes left in the first? 2 minutes left in the first.
I've been asked to read the following. When the moon is in the seventh house, and Jupiter... No. We have a wonderful gift for Ariel as I wait for our skilled panelists to bring up our questions.
Thanks a lot.
It was a great talk.
Thanks.
And, you had the dean worried for a little bit at the beginning of the talk. So, and now I think we have our skilled volunteers will provide the dean guy with a question. Or two. Actually, I have a question at the end too. But so, what was there any efficacy in the stuff that the homeopathic guy gave you back in the 80s, or is it just?
Actually, I don't know because these were just pills. By the way, one approach is with these solutions that I talked about. You don't have to drink it. They can also apply to pills. Okay, so it will take solid. But I didn't know what it was. Okay, it just gave me this. Actually, there is an interesting aftermath to this whole story, which I did not mention. Remember, this was I got this problem 24 years ago. Well, yeah, it was 26 years ago. Was it 26, 24? A long time ago. Okay, and it went away on its own. But actually, unfortunately, 6 years ago, I got it back. Okay, interesting enough. What is if I went to all the doctors? Okay. Nothing worked. Guess what? I knew it didn't make sense. Where did I go? I went to see an homeopath. You know, when you're really desperate, you do it. But I can tell you this time it did not work at all. Okay? It did not work at all. I didn't feel any better at all. So I think the only explanation I had is that the first time, it was the same doctor, but the first time he was much nicer.
Okay.
What? It's really not clear what it is. I think they believe it's some sort of autoimmune disease. Okay, actually now they don't believe it was fibromyalgia. They believe it was something called erythromelalgia. Okay, when you see these big words, it's scary. Okay, which is actually a constriction of a small blood vessel. But they're really not sure as to what it was, and it's by elimination. If it's nothing else, then it could be that. And interestingly enough, the first time it took about 2 years for it to go away, and this time also it took about 2 years for it to go away. So it's roughly every 20 years, okay? Now I'm 67. I know, by 87, I think I'll get used to it.
Okay, and we'll start our questions. And this question, the quality of the question is matched only by the quality and precision of the handwriting. So, and I know it's a woman. I can tell the men from the women. I'm sure it's. Does a placebo effect provide measurable physiological improvements in a patient, as well as a psychological, that is, state of the mind improvements?
Well, it's very difficult to measure, have a quantitative measure of placebo. But essentially, when you talk about placebo effect, it's how many people felt better. Okay, and roughly the numbers that are mentioned is something like 30%. 30% of patients will feel better just on the basis of the placebo. I don't know if I answered that question properly.
Are there physiological effects, measurable physiological effects as well?
No. It's in the mind, in people's mind.
Here we have a more pointed question, and it's also beautifully written. Why do I say these things? I don't know. Anyway, how can you explain how incredibly well homeopathy works on animals and infants? It isn't a placebo. I could show you dozens and dozens of cases. Belladonna. Look at a baby with a high fever, glassy eyes, red face, and radiating heat. Give him or her a dose, and it'll be gone in 5 minutes.
Well, who decides that? But that's the whole point. These are the studies that are not properly blinded. You know, if you are the parents and you give this to your infant and you believe that it's going to work, of course you're going to notice some improvement. That's the same thing people say, how can you say that placebo doesn't work? Because actually in cats it seems to work as well. But who decides that the cats get better? Does the cats go, meow? No, of course. You know, this randomization and the blinding is very important. And that's why this Jadad effect is so important, to make sure that it's properly blinded.
I think you answered this partly in your talk, but could you talk about the difference between a homeopathic and a naturopathic treatment?
Okay. By the way... natural medicine in general term and homeopathic medicine have nothing in common. Okay? The basic idea behind homeopathic medicine is the principle of dilution. Okay? And in contrast to herbal medicine, natural medicine, as I told you, in homeopathic medicine, they are not interested in the disease, what causes the disease. They're only interested in the symptoms. Okay, so that it's totally different. In that sense, I could say that natural medicine is more like conventional medicine. And in fact, many of the drugs that we use actually were natural drugs before, you know, like salicylic acid and the like, the bark of the willow tree. Eventually, it was shown that there was some active substance. One point I'd like to make is that, I didn't have time to mention it, is that often... the people, the homeopathic practitioners, they say, well, actually, our remedy work in the same way as vaccine. They stimulate the immune system. Well, this is nonsense, because in fact, in the case of vaccine, you give a measurable amount of substance, and you get a measurable amount of antibodies that will form. So this is not proper.
Okay. Do placebo effects last as long, or how long do they last compared to a real medical treatment when they seem to be efficacious?
Well, this is very difficult to measure. It depends on the individual. It depends on the practitioner. So you cannot say that, you know, the placebo effect is really very, how could I say, mysterious in a sense. It's not something that is easily measured. Because you are the person, it depends on the type of individual. Two people that are given the same placebo will have different effects. Okay? It depends how you interact with the clinician.
Yeah, that's related to this question, which is also beautifully handwritten. Even if homeopathy does not work, it does seem that at least the approach from the doctor works, more interest in the patient, and it showed the wards of homeopathy there. They're so nice compared to the Royal Vic or the Jewish. So should not medicine pick up on some of this?
Well, they should in terms of bedside manner, maybe.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, that absolutely. I mean, why is homeopathy so popular? Among other things, is that homeopathic doctors take great care, or they care, or they show care to their patient, and this is extremely a very important feature. Now, the only qualm I have about homeopathy is when they use this type of jargon that doesn't make any sense, and also when it is used instead of treatment that can be helpful. Like, for instance, oscillococcin I'm using instead of the H1N1 vaccine. Now, fortunately, we didn't have a major outbreak, but let's say had we had a major outbreak, all these people that were taking oscillococcin, I mean, they would not have been protected.
Here's a fun question. I enjoy just asking this one. Were there any benefits to traditional alternative medicine practices like bloodletting and leeches?
Benefit to the leeches, maybe. No, in fact, now this traditional, this type of medicine were really pretty bad, and you know, the treatment worked, but the patient died. You know.
Why did you put omega-3 and garlic and ginger and all that in the category of alternative medicines in your presentation?
But because this is the way it is classified by the directorate of herbal and alternative treatment. That's where they put it. Okay.
What is cold FX, and what is its value?
Now this is interesting.
Good.
Cold FX is a ginseng. It's based on ginseng, and it's supposed there is one study that shows that there is a minimal amount of benefits if it's taken in a preventive fashion. Okay, so you have to take it before. In contrast to what people believe, it will not actually cure a cold. Okay, in the studies, it will show you have to take it. During the cold season, you have to take it every day. And essentially, I can't remember the amount. I have it in one of my lectures. Is that what this study shows is that it will prevent the equivalent of something like one cold in 100 people. I don't remember the exact number, but that's the benefits are minimal. Okay, and the cost is something like, if you take a pill every day, the cost is something like $400 a season. So essentially, you're going to spend $400 to prevent one cold in 100 people.
So Canadians use it.
What?
Canadians use it.
Yeah, well, it works. Whatever works. But in the case of cold FX, it's a marketing. Okay, the marketing is really what makes it so.
I'm afraid there's only time for one last question, which is mine.
Isn't it, what is the score?
No, I've got a real question. I like to ask real questions. So you mentioned that, diluting down to where it's less than one molecule in the thing is crazy, right? How could that happen? But are there cases where dilution, where the effect is not proportional to the amount there? And the thing that occurs to me is everyone knows that smoking's bad and you get cancer from it. But secondhand smoke, the amount of smoke that you get that way from someone else who smokes your house is actually not infinitesimal, much less than it is from someone who's just breathing it in. Mm-hmm. So is there something to the idea that in some cases a diluted amount of something can still have serious effects, even harmful effects?
Not to the extent at which they are diluted. Realize when you go 10 to the 30, this is more diluted than Avogadro's number, which is 10 to the 23rd. So at this level, there is essentially nothing left.
With that, before we thank Ariel, and then everybody go home and watch the rest of the hockey game, I guess. Look, I'd like to thank our organizers, our volunteers today. Great job. Thanks for your interesting questions and for listening and putting up with my shtick. And don't forget to fill out the evaluation forms on the way out. Next week is the last of our mini-science series for this year, and our speaker will be Lauren Trache. The title of Lauren's talk is Are Cell Phones and Wi-Fi Harmful to Your Health?
Please make sure you return the clickers, and they're two different colors, so make sure they go into the right box, okay?
Okay.
As you go outside, you'll notice that there is one box. I can't remember the color. You remember the color?
You're cutting into your applause, Ariel. Let's thank Ariel again for a very nice talk.
Okay. was fun. Yeah.